We started a series on the Ten Commandments, and we've got to number two tonight, so I'd be grateful if you'd turn in the Bibles, which are in the seats in front of you, to page 65 of the Old Testament section of the Bible, page 65, where we can read the Second Commandment, Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 to 6. You shall not make for yourself a graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not make for yourself a graven image. The immediate reaction of 20th century Western man is to think, how quaint. And rather like the prophet in our first reading, which we had earlier this evening, we pour scorn on the sort of people who could possibly make something out of stone or out of wood and bow down and worship it. The prophet said it was ridiculous. We think it's ridiculous. How quaint that anybody should even think of doing such a thing. 20th century man dismisses it as far below his intelligence, not even worth considering as a practical proposition. Nobody in this day and age would think about carving something and worshipping it. We've outgrown that sort of nonsense. It's just superstition. And yet you don't have to look very far in our society to see how superstition abounds. Lucky charms, horoscopes, and so on. How the worship of the material is rife, and the true God, who is spirit, is ignored. Maybe fewer people carve images in stone than previously in the world's history, I don't know. But most probably, people have an image carved indelibly in their minds, which is just as much an idol. And that doesn't just go for those outside of the Christian faith, it goes for those inside it as well, for you and for me. We have in our minds something carved which takes the place of God. And we're going to consider for a few minutes tonight something, just a little, of what those things might be. And hopefully to be able to tear them from our minds and just to worship God alone. To tear from our minds the image made in our own liking and after our image, not after the image of God. We're going to consider three aspects of idolatry. And the first is what I've called the origins of idolatry. And I think two things contribute to idolatry. Strangely, one is God's nature, and the other is man's nature. Firstly, God's nature. God is spirit. Our second reading had that. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. God is spirit. He has no body, no form resembling anything in this world, and yet he's all-powerful, and he's all-pervasive through our universe. He demands our total allegiance, and yet we have no picture which we can ascribe to him. There's no way we can picture him in our minds because he has no form. And that contributes to idolatry. Yes, we know God's character, we know what he's like, we see that revealed in the Lord Jesus Christ, but we don't have what he looks like. And because of this, all down history, men have made symbols to represent to them the thing that they can't see. The God whom they know, but can't picture. Someone has called them solid metaphors. Helps that enable us to represent to ourselves God. And in one sense, in a very limited sense, that's no bad thing. In that if it helps somebody to worship the true God, then maybe there's some real value in it. But, and it's a big but, that doesn't allow for man's nature. As you're only too obviously aware, aids to worship rapidly become objects of worship. And things that are meant to help us in our worship rapidly become the whole point of it. Man's nature is such that things get corrupted. And it's in man's nature to make the means to the end in itself. And he does just that with symbols, which are meant to help him in his worship of God, because they become the things which are worshipped. The things which are supposed to take the worshipper's mind and direct them to God become the things which he worships here on earth. Let me give you an illustration or two to sharpen up the point I'm trying to make. First, an illustration from the history of Israel. Do you remember the story in Numbers when the children of Israel were in the wilderness and they were subject to a plague of snakes? And many people were suffering as a result. And God instructed Moses to make a brass serpent, to put it on a pole, to raise it up in the camp, so that any who had the faith in God, all they had to do was to look to the brass serpent and they would be healed. The serpent was a symbol, if you like, of God's healing power. Now, it wasn't magical. It wasn't that the brass serpent healed them. It was that they had to have the faith to look to the brass serpent who represented the healing power of God. It was a focus for faith in the God who could heal. But what happened? Well, people were healed in that occasion, and so they took the brass serpent with them. And the next time we read of it in the Bible, it turns up in the temple in King Hezekiah's time. And by then, it was part of the temple furniture. It was standing up in the temple, having incense burnt to it in front of it. The symbol of God's power in healing had become an object of worship rather than the God to whom it was supposed to point. Symbolism had moved over into idolatry. And the prophets throughout the history of Israel railed against this type of thing, which happened all the time. Let's bring the illustration nearer to our own time with an illustration from church history. The Lord's Supper is a powerful symbol. It speaks graphically of Christ's broken body. It speaks powerfully of Christ's shed blood. We take it and we eat it in remembrance that he died for us. But in some parts of the church, the symbol has become the end in itself and not just a means to the end. The symbol has become an object of worship and veneration. And again, the danger of idolatry. What is a wonderful, God-given symbol which should help us to worship the one true God becomes a snare. And as you look through the Bible, as you look through church history, this happens time and time and time again. And I shall give some more examples later. But of course, again, as we shall see later, this isn't restricted to what one might describe as the ritualistic branches of the church. The origins of idolatry are just the same, whatever sort of form of service you might worship with. Because the origins of idolatry lie in the fact that God is spirit, and that as man, symbols which are meant to help us, in fact, become the objects of worship themselves. But before we leave the origins of idolatry, there's just one more important fact to be noted. In our Old Testament lesson from Isaiah chapter 44, the prophet takes the mickey unmercifully out of those who make idols. He says he cooks a fire on a fire made of the same bit of wood that he worships. How incredibly stupid can you get? Why doesn't he see what he's doing, says the prophet? And the answer is that he has been blinded by his disobedience and by his idolatry. He doesn't see because he doesn't want to see. And I think that's true of many people. The idolater knows that his God is man-made, but he likes it that way. In fact, life is a lot more comfy if you have a God that you can control rather than having a God who controls you. An idol is a manageable substitute for the real thing. The idolater has shut his mind to the truth because it's more comfy to live with a lie. A God made in man's image is a much easier option than to believe that God made us in his image with all the consequent demands that that makes on us. The origins of idolatry then are in God's nature unseen and unimaginable, and in man's nature that he corrupts the good symbols and turns them into things he can control and worship. God's made after the likeness of man. So there are some origins of idolatry. Secondly, we move on to what I call the manifestations of idolatry. Because so far you may have said, well, this sounds all very remote. This is theory. This looks back to church history. This looks back to the Bible. None of it touches me. And maybe you're saying to yourself, I don't see much sign of idolatry round about me, frankly. I see no images being venerated. I see no symbols being worshipped. I don't fall into the trap of taking religious symbols and making them the objects of worship. But I'm afraid I have to tell you that, to paraphrase, idolatry is alive and well and living in all souls. It's alive and well and living in you and living in me. Idolatry is rife in the church and in the world. Let's think about each of those in turn. First of all, it's alive in the church. I've already given one example from Israel's history and one from church history, but there are other examples which are just as relevant, even though they might be slightly more subtle. What matters to some people in the church is that everything is done properly, with the right procedures, and with the right order. And this has become the driving force for church life amongst certain people. Some clergy I've met, and may I say also not a small proportion of lay people, seem to have lost sight of the fact that the church is not procedures. That the church procedures are meant to help them serve the living God rather than so they can be devoted to the system. But people are devoted to the system because it's easier and less demanding to serve a system than it is to serve the living God. It's easier to control forms of worship than to be controlled by God himself. When you catch yourself saying, but that's not the way we do it here, beware of idolatry. Has the way that we do things taken over for you from the emphasis on the living God? What is more important, the way we do something, a particular doctrine, or God himself? The next examples might be nearer at home for some of us, I think. Because I think often Christians can get hold of one aspect of Christian truth, and turn it into an idol. One particular doctrine or emphasis can become for them the be-all and end-all of their Christian lives. Let me give you some examples. It might be something like Sunday observance. However much one agrees, and I may say quickly that I agree with all these things that I'm about to mention. However much one agrees with the main aim of people like the Lord's Day Observance Society, is there not a danger that Sunday observance can become an idol? That the very reason for Sunday observance becomes lost, God himself gets lost, and something else, the Sabbath or whatever, is put in its place. And that becomes the reason for a person's existence. Not God. Well, then again, it might be the challenge to simple lifestyle. Again, a very important and necessary part of the Christian life. But for some folk, it takes over. It takes the whole of their thinking, the whole of their emphasis, and they talk about nothing else. Is there not the danger of idolatry? Well, then again, and this is where it comes home to roost with me, some of us are sold on the importance of small groups in the life of the church. But when that becomes an end in itself, and not a means of serving the living God, isn't idolatry lurking at the door? Or again, many Protestants pride themselves on their simple, plain services. There's no scope for ritualistic idolatry in our services. But if anyone dares to suggest that just one part of the service might be changed, then everybody's up in arms. The time-honoured, simple worship has become an idol, as elaborate as any ritual. Or again, many folk have been brought into a greater awareness of God by the charismatic movement, and we rejoice at that. But some people have such a bee in their bonnet about one particular gift that it's become an idol, and the giver of those gifts is completely forgotten. Idolatry couching at the door. Or again, what do you tell people about All Souls who've never been here? Do you tell them about the large congregation, about the large number of fellowship groups we run, or the activities we provide, about the splendid music, about the great preaching from the rector? Don't see anything funny in that. Or the great facilities we've got downstairs. What do you tell them about? Those are the things I tell people about. But I wonder if we shouldn't tell them that this is a place where we meet Sunday by Sunday with the living God as we meet with his people. But that's the last thing we think of. We focus on God himself in this church, but do we? Michael was reminding us this morning how important it is that God is at the centre of our worship. And that's what we should tell people about. Because if you're anything like me and you talk about the other things, then idolatry couches at the door. We idolise success, we idolise numbers, we idolise fellowship groups, we idolise human achievement. Far more than we focus on the living God. And one could go on adding to this list over and over again. Things which Christians get hold of and turn into idols. Particular styles of worship, of music, of liturgy, of prayers. All can become more important than God himself. And that's the essence of idolatry. Anything, however religious, which goes in the place of God. Idolatry is alive and well and living in the church. Idolatry, secondly, is alive and well and living in the world. And by that, I don't just mean the idolatry of those of us not here tonight, those people not here tonight, because Christians can be just as open to secular idolatry as they can to religious idolatry. Rather glibly, we can all run off things which are idols in the world. Money, success, status, pleasure. Glibly, because we think it doesn't apply to us, it only applies to the people who are not here. It's always the other person that's materialistic, never you and me. Have you noticed that? Our text says, "You shall not bow down to them or serve them," these graven images. Worship's not just bowing down, worship is also serving, putting your whole life into something. And many people in our society serve other things. Many people in church tonight, maybe, serve other things than the living God. Worship is serving some material end, whether it's work or money or whatever. The other night, after I finished work about 10:30, I switched on the television to see if there was any escapist rubbish I could watch for half an hour. And on all three programmes, I still don't quite believe it, but in fact, on all three programmes, they were current affairs programmes, and they were all talking about money. We're a nation obsessed with money. Every political party says its number one aim is to get inflation down. No one stops to ask why that should be number one aim, although the answer, of course, is simple, so that our money will be worth more. Every political party says that the prosperity of the nation and the prosperity of the individual are its main aims. They may have different ways and different beliefs of getting to that aim, but they're the same aims. And whether Christians or not, we accept that quite without flinching. We acknowledge on Sunday with our lips in church that we seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness. But in the real world, for the rest of the week, what really matters is the value of the money in our pocket and the scandal of 20% inflation. You see, we're bound up with the system. We bow down and we serve it. If it's not the idol of money, perhaps it's the idol of status. To many people, it matters desperately whether they're in with a particular group of friends, particular group of people, particular social gathering, or out. It matters desperately whether they're known in the right circles, go to the right parties, meet the right people. And being accepted is the ultimate aim of their lives. Well, there again, there's the idol of pleasure. You don't have to belong to the Playboy Club to make pleasure the driving force of your life. Of course, as with so many of these things I've been mentioning, pleasure is not in itself evil. God created us to enjoy things and to enjoy his world. But it's not that the pleasure and Christian faith are opposed, far from it. In fact, I think, personally, I have far more fun out of life than a lot of people who go chasing after pleasure. Maybe you feel the same. But for many, pleasure comes before God himself. Seek first, says Jesus, my kingdom and my righteousness, and all these things will be yours as well. But it's a lesson we don't learn very easily. Then there's the idol of fulfillment. I think increasingly this is a god, including a god for many Christians. What matters is that I'm fulfilled in life. But that's an idol. See, the wonderful truth of the Christian faith is that, and I've not said this, this isn't the first time I've said this from this pulpit, the wonderful truth about the Christian faith is that putting God first is the most fulfilling thing. But how difficult it is to get that over to people. How difficult to get over to people that, in fact, in seeking fulfillment, you don't find it. But in seeking God, you find the most fulfilling life imaginable. Well, there again, there are those who throw themselves wholeheartedly into some cause or other, whether it's into preserving steam engines or Nash buildings. Now, preserving steam engines and Nash buildings are totally worthwhile and legitimate enterprises, particularly the former. But when they become the raison d'etre for people's lives, they become idolatrous. And I've met people whose whole life is bound up with one cause such as preserving a steam engine. Now you laugh. But it's true. And it's desperately sad. What's your life bound up with? What is number one? Is it to get married? Is it to have a fulfilling career? What is number one? That's the question. Because if the answer is not God and God alone, idolatry is couching at the door. What is your idol? I might not have mentioned it this evening, but by now you may have an inkling of what it is. When I referred earlier to the brass serpent being found in Hezekiah's temple, do you know what the conclusion of that story was? When Hezekiah heard that incense was being burnt to it, he took that serpent and broke it in pieces. I think that is the most amazing and radical thing for anybody to have done at that time. Imagine, the very serpent that the great lawgiver of Israel, Moses himself, had set up in the wilderness some 500 years before, had become a snare, and so Hezekiah said, that's it, it goes, we break it up. What would be a parallel for us? Maybe tearing down St. Paul's Cathedral because people had started to worship it. You say, you can't do that, it's a national... And the brass serpent was a national monument. It had been there and had been symbolic of what God had done for his people in the past. But he'd become an idol, so it was torn down, and rightly so. That's the radical surgery that's needed if we're to avoid idolatry in our lives. So thirdly, we come to the remedy for idolatry. And the remedy comes in the words of Jesus himself. Those words to the woman of Samaria that we had read as our second reading. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. What does this mean? It means, I believe, primarily coming to terms with who God is and putting him first. It means genuine worship, spiritual worship with no pretense. It means no compromise with material things. It means the rejection of all that challenges God for first place in our lives, all that challenges God for our affection, all that challenges God for our service. Let me ask you a question. Why did you come to church this evening? Was it because you liked the informal music services, particularly? Or because your exams were over, so you've got a little bit more time now? Or because you always come on Sunday evening? Or did you come because you wanted to worship the living God? Did you want to meet him in the company of his people? Did you want to hear him speak from his word? So much of our worship is shallow because we're shallow people. So much of our worship is shallow because our motives for worship are mixed. We don't meet with God in worship because we don't expect to meet with God in worship. We don't expect to meet God in worship because our hearts are not fixed on God alone. And our hearts are not fixed on God alone because we've got an idol lurking somewhere. I challenge you to examine yourself carefully, to break down the petty gods which you serve. May I challenge you to come to worship expecting to meet with the living God, expecting to hear the living God speak to you. What a difference that would make to the feel of worship together if we all came, every one of us, expecting to hear him, meeting with him. What a difference that would make. What a difference it would make if we all came to wait on God's Spirit and worship him in spirit and in truth. Our text adds a warning. It says, "The Lord your God is a jealous God. He tolerates no rivals." And as we look at those verses in Exodus 20 in which this second commandment is seen, we see the cumulative effect of idolatry to the third and fourth generation. Now, jealousy is the proper response of God to our idolatry. It's the reaction to the usurping of something that's properly his own. Just as the reaction of a marriage partner to anyone who tries to usurp their position in a marriage is one of jealousy, and rightly so. So God is jealous of anything which usurps him from that throne. To our God belongs the whole universe, including ourselves. We mustn't allow anything created, nothing and nobody, to pull us away from him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Let us pray. Return, O holy dove, return, sweet messenger of rest. I hate the sins that made thee mourn and drove thee from my breast. The dearest idol I have known, whate'er that idol be, help me to tear it from thy throne and worship only thee. Amen.